everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the HD View Ask Dr. Goodman Show. This is Melissa Biliardi, your host. Tonight, our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1, we'll cue you into the show. Please tell all your colleagues, friends, and family about Health HD Radio and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. Thank you, 58,100 listeners, for tuning in. And it's time to ask Dr. Goodman your questions about the care and treatment of Huntington's disease. Tonight, the topic is, What's Empathy Got to Do with It? Love that title. Read her article at www.hddrugworks.org. Ask Dr. Goodman your questions. Sit back, listen to the show. Dr. Goodman's listeners have grown to more than 10,500 strong, and every month we get to have direct contact with one of the leading physicians who cares with empathy for our HDers and JHDers. Welcome to your show, Dr. Goodman. How are you tonight?
I'm good. Hello.
And happy belated Easter.
Oh, yes, indeed. We had summer here, 70 degrees in Seattle yesterday.
Wow.
It was gorgeous. Yeah.
That's wonderful. And we had showers, like April showers already. So, well, let's talk about empathy. Let's define it first and tell us how it relates to Huntington's disease.
Right. I actually thought of this topic because in last month's topic, thinking about how to deal with the anosognosia, remember that long word,
yep.
Lack of awareness from last time. And one of my my recommendations was to have empathy.
Right.
And so I got to thinking, well, what is empathy? And so I went back and researched it a little bit and from a couple of different levels, and found it very useful,
mm-hmm.
For thinking about care in Huntington's. I think it's good to when you define empathy, it is good to say what it isn't first. You know, how is sympathy or compassion or empathy different?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we have sympathy or sad or feeling sorry for something that has happened to another person, that is sympathy when we're feeling sorry. We're feeling compassion, too, when you see on TV, you know, starving children in Africa. You have compassion and sympathy for that situation, the people in that situation. But so you feel for them, and empathy is that plus feeling as them,
mm-hmm.
really walking, doing the best that one can do. You never can do it completely, of course, but walking in that other person's shoes, how does it feel for them? Yes, we feel bad for some other situation where someone is having problems, but do we feel like that person? Can we get to that level? And that's what empathy is about. It's feeling as another, walking in someone else's shoes.
Right, and for those of our HD and JHD community, those who are caring for their loved ones who have HD and who are caring for those who have HD can have this empathy. I mean, they know exactly
well,
what
course.
It is.
We are exposed to it in our families. Pain and suffering over long years of time that our loved ones go through. And we do put ourselves in their shoes, I think.
Yeah.
And there is value to that in terms of you can't really help someone if you don't feel as to know what's happening. And I guess that's another point I wanted to, a very important point is if you know more about the disease as a person who has Huntington's or a person who is loving and caring for someone who has Huntington's. If you know more about what goes wrong in the disease, how can you walk in someone else's shoes if you don't you don't know what they're going through?
Mm-hmm.
So not, I mean, you know, you're saddened by their suffering, but if you know what they're going through, you can have empathy with what they have lost, and then you can go a step further and deal with that loss.
Right. I hear people talking about people in our community that have HD saying, well, there's no way that you could possibly understand what I'm going through if you don't have this. And that's true. I mean, I've talked to my own son in that way, and no, I don't know exactly what he's going through. I have sympathy and compassion for him, but I don't know.
But you can also learn what things are happening in HD. And yes, it's right. Rational and it's intellectual, but one can then, as much as possible, put it in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Could you hold on 1 second? I may have an emergency call.
Oh, dear.
I'm going to cut out a minute.
Okay, sure. We're going to talk here in a minute about empathy in the bioneurologic level, what that means. We'll be talking about mirror neuron system. And if you all can go to her website, www.hddrugworks.org, the article, What's Empathy Got to Do with It, is posted right there on her website. It's an excellent article.
I'm back. I'm sorry.
There she is. Okay, so I was just explaining to our listeners that we were going to be talking about the bioneurologic level of empathy.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Is everything okay?
Learning. Yeah. I could take care of it over the phone, so that is
okay. Good.
Alrighty. I personally think it's always if there's something known about the molecular biology and the neurons in the brain, that helps me understand the process that's affected. So if we learn about, well, you know, what part of the brain is where does empathy happen?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from a molecular and neurologic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that it happens, it's not a simple process, as one might imagine, and that it's not one process. It's a very complicated, interconnected process. So what scientists do is, you know, they find a system that they look at, which is involved in empathy, but it's not the total answer. There are other systems that interact with it. So the one of the interesting ones, one of the first ones discovered, I think, was the mirror neuron system, and it explains what happens. It was discovered in monkeys, actually, who when yawning happens, a set of neurons light up in the brain, and you can see this on a certain kind of MRI, a brain imaging, and then if you have another monkey watching that monkey, exactly the same neurons will light up in that second monkey. And then the yawning will go back and forth, and each of them will have the same neuron system activated, whether they're actually doing the yawning or whether they are just watching it.
Well, I've done that before. I'm not a monkey.
Yeah, no, I mean, humans have this system as well.
Wow.
And it's one that's implicated in when you see a person smile at you, you know, walking down the street and they smile at you, you tend to smile back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, under the right circumstances, you're not walking in a dark alley or something, but in the usual social situation, when you smile at someone, they'll smile back. If you're hostile to someone, they're likely to be pretty hostile back, because we can recognize facial expressions and we respond, in a sense, automatically to them. And this is a mirror neuron process.
Interesting.
Now, it's probably not that simple, but kind of think of it that way. And this was thought to be, well, if you're literally putting yourself in that person's shoes, that person's yawning, and you actually yawn. So you know what yawning is. Even if you don't yawn, you have to suppress it. So you have the feeling of yawning.
So apparently the mirror neuron system is not affected in early HD?
Well, it is.
It is.
That is the that system is affected because in early HD, people can and other problems as well.
Okay.
You know, Asperger's and Parkinson's disease, schizophrenia. It's also impaired that when they see someone smile, they cannot interpret what that facial expression is.
Okay.
Or hostility. And often it's, so when they, see, and I have patients who respond hostily, respond with hostility or fear to someone who smiles at them because they misinterpret it.
Okay.
And you can imagine, you know, you have an interaction then that is you don't understand what's happening. Why is this person all of a sudden, I'm not understanding this behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's useful to know that because how can you have empathy if you don't understand that that's happening, that kind of reaction? So if you have knowledge that your motivation cannot be or your mood cannot be transmitted effectively to another person just by your facial expression, and that when that happens in a marriage relationship or such, the person loses the ability to respond in the same way to their spouse or partner. And it's misinterpreted as a personality change or not caring. See where I'm going?
Yeah. Now,
did I explain it okay?
You further mentioned in your article, in the second paragraph under in early HD, you say, but importantly, investigators showed what was not known before, these individuals have intact ability to understand feelings and emotion in self and to understand the feelings and emotions of others, empathy.
Right. There are various, the investigators, there are various ways you can measure empathy, you know, towards yourself
mm-hmm.
and empathy towards another in a written, validated test. So, emotions are understood, and there is empathy felt that they wouldn't be able to see in an expression.
Right.
So if you talk to people and tell them that, you know, you're sad or you're upset about something, instead of using just a facial expression, and, facial expressions are important. We communicate many things that way, usually, but people with Huntington's can't do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to use our words.
Right.
Don't assume that that person understands what your facial expression means. And so don't misinterpret the response.
And don't
misinterpret
to each other. Their facial expressions.
Right.
Yeah. Good point.
People with Huntington's have difficulty making the facial expression.
Right.
So you can't read them, and they can't read you by looking at your expression, by looking at your face, or even body language. But
how
verbalizing
does that impact the care of our HDers and JHDers?
If you don't understand, you know, for instance, if someone responds to you, you believe it's inappropriate to a facial expression, or you know, you get upset about something, but you don't tell them why.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. They may not know you're upset about something because they can't read on your face that you're upset. It's as if they were blind to your expression. If you had a blind person, you would not expect them to respond to your facial expression, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they are essentially blind to interpret that facial expression.
And they may misinterpret.
Yes, so they don't know how to read it. And in fact,
that's very interesting.
It is misread often. And so if we know that when we're interacting with someone, then with Huntington's, if it's our spouse, our partner, our child, then we know that to get our feelings across to that person, best would be to use our words, to talk. And if the person with Huntington's is aware of this as well, then encourage that person to talk when things start bothering them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and at least in the situations, in nursing home situations where I've seen this, it works tremendously well. So it's not just early Huntington's, it's late Huntington's as well. And that way you know where they're coming from.
Yes. Now, what happens when the communication goes away? I mean, when they
You still communicate, you still talk, they still hear, and you can understand, you can communicate that. You know, it's a one-way communication.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to use your words. You have to talk for them.
Can you use
talk
pictures
them?
Or... Can they?
Certainly that is one way that one can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Often, if speech becomes very impaired, then using simple sentences that are yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
Pictures are also very helpful. It's useful to have people learn how to do this before the speech is very impaired, because it's hard to learn to do something if you don't have the speech to communicate. So it's best to do it before you have to.
Oh, someone just said we used to use communication boards at the group homes.
Yes. Yeah. Certainly.
Is there a delay in the communication response?
Yes. I mean, there is. Huntington's delays both cognitively and motor will delay. There will be a slowness of action, whether it's cognitive or whether it's motor. So, yes, there is a slowness in response as Huntington's becomes more advanced.
Mm-hmm. So it's not that they don't want to answer you. It's they're not processing.
It's difficult to process and to answer.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of energy.
Ooh, okay.
It's not a lack of, and that sigh that you gave was an empathetic sigh. You felt what that would be like.
Yes. And, you know, some days I'm dealing with that, some days not. It's more days now than not. The delay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about our doctors? And are they able to empathize with our HDers?
I'll go back a step. How empathetic are doctors in general? We tend to lose it by the second year of medical school.
Ooh.
Well, we get through the first 2 years of medical school, and we have empathy. I mean, they've done these studies on medical students. And then when they put us on the wards, you know, when you start seeing patients, empathy actually goes down. And why is that? I don't think it's really known. We aren't taught to be empathetic. We are taught to stay a distance. Nurses aren't taught to be distant from patients, but doctors are. You're supposed to maintain an objective distance, and if you get too involved personally, then you won't be able to make best objective judgments. And there's some truth in that. one has to back away a little bit because you'd be paralyzed if you had empathy for every person at a high level. You would be, a doctor would pretty soon be paralyzed after seeing, you know, one sick person after another coming in and out of their office. So what happens is doctors tend to put up a little shield. They also, and they also learn to be objective. They look at it as an interest or as a problem that needs to be fixed, and that you want a doctor to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want them to just feel. You want them to actually do something.
Objectively.
So we concentrate on, I think doctors concentrate on doing things. We're also in our medical systems now not given much time to do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an internist, I was expected to see 15, 20 patients a day. And unless it was an awfully simple problem, you can't deal with other issues other than, you know, that particular complaint that person came in. You can't do it very well. So our systems make it harder as well. If our doctors are empathetic, people do better with their medical situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that in the article too, that, you know, we all intuitively know that that's going to be so. If you have somebody who cares about you, you know, then you're likely to do better. They're going to ask the right questions. They're going to see why it is that you couldn't do something, you know, know more about your life and your situation. Those kinds of doctors will have people who actually do better medically, and that's not a big surprise. We all know that makes complete sense, but it was never really shown until last year or so in a trial.
Oh, which trial was that?
That was the one. There were a couple of them. One was done in Pennsylvania, one in Italy, and it involved diabetic patients.
Oh.
But they measured outcomes like being hospitalized with a diabetes emergency. You were much less likely to require being hospitalized or be very sick from diabetes if you had an empathetic doctor.
Interesting.
So
how can we work with our doctors to help them be more empathetic? Because, I mean, some of our doctors are seeing patients every, you know, 5-10 minutes.
I know. Been there, done that.
Yeah.
It is, you can sometimes try to catch them, and if they're catchable,
mm-hmm.
then you will and have them stop for a minute and say, "Doc, can we talk about this?" And some will say, "No, you have to make another appointment and come back." Then you know you have the wrong doctor. Unfortunately, we don't have Huntington's people don't have a lot of choice in doctors.
Mm-hmm.
All we can do is, I glibly say, "Well, go find another doctor." Well, that's not so easy.
No.
To find another doctor for Huntington. So it's not an ideal world. We try to find the best doctor that we can, and if you had the choice between a good doctor with empathy and one with less, you want the one with empathy, the one
mm-hmm.
who feels as much as you, kind of, and not just knows the disease, but knows the situation that you are in. I think sometimes caretakers, care partners are given, I know they are, given a short shrift because the problem is concentrated on as opposed to the situation at home.
Do you think that some doctors are starting to pay a little bit more attention to the caregivers and what they're saying than before?
I think so, and I think that's increasingly so in Huntington's. And I think part of that is, you know, finally researchers have said this is important. Things that families have been saying is important for a long time.
That's good.
That things happen before motor symptoms often that are important and need care. Families we're proved right, and are, you know, correct about a lot of. I mean, people need, doctors need to listen to families also, not exclusively to families, but to families and to the patient.
Well, now last month we talked about agnosia. Now today we're talking about empathy, and we're talking about, you know, how doctors are starting to listen to caregivers a little bit more maybe now. Could it be because there's that element of awareness, lack of awareness, agnosia?
The lack of awareness, whose lack of awareness?
In the patient, that maybe the doctors are starting to listen a little bit more to the caregivers?
I would hope so. That's one reason, yes. Because there's less awareness of one's own symptoms, you need to also get information from a care partner. Mm-hmm. But one also needs to realize that, you know, the doctor's in a delicate position there.
Right.
Because the patient is your patient, and that's your primary responsibility. Mm-hmm. And sometimes doctors think, well, I need to listen to that person, even though I know the information might be important from a care person, but what the patient tells me, I have to listen to that too, because they're not a fly on the wall.
Right.
So they're in a difficult position of, you know, you want to support both people, the patient and the care partner, but the patient is your patient. And I think doctors tend to err on that side than on the care person side.
Right. So when is there too much empathy going on? How can we temper the empathy?
Well, if you feel as the person, if you suffer an equal amount, then you will have less energy to care for that person.
Mm-hmm.
If you, too, get down and are exhausted and depressed and hopeless, helpless, or whatever, and get isolated in that, you can't help anyone. So it's so important to tell yourself that, to when you have a moment, to back up and say, it's okay not to care so deeply today. It's okay. I'll be empathetic tomorrow. That doesn't mean you're mean today. It means that you can back up. Don't be so hard on yourself. Let something else in beside that person's suffering. Besides, you know, feeling every loss. Sometimes families will feel it more heavily than the patient themselves. I have seen that. I think there are days on which I still feel that. That, you know, I worry about what's coming and I grieve for that too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's helpful, right? It isn't helpful. So you have to step. In some ways it's realistic, but if you wallow in it, forgive me, that's a word I use when I when I want to back up.
Mm-hmm.
I say, don't wallow in this. It's okay to back up.
Yeah.
It's okay to think about something else, or do something else.
Take a break.
So too much empathy is too much of a good thing, is what I said. Mm-hmm. And that's caregiver burnout. Then you become a less pleasant person, a less good caretaker. And if that's if you can convince yourself of that, maybe you'll allow yourself a little more time and energy for yourself.
Yeah.
And I know that's hard to get when you are 24/7. But you have to do the best you can within each situation. Blog Talk Radio is a way of talking with other people and sharing experiences. That helps. Support groups help. Do they solve the problem? Do they make it go away? No. Do they give you a minute of respite when you share the load, or know that you're not alone in sharing the load, that other people are sharing or have their loads too? Somehow that helps. I'm not sure why, but it does.
Yeah, it does.
Allowing yourself not to feel empathy every second, every minute of every waking day is something very important.
It's kind of exhausting work, isn't it?
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Because it takes your soul too, if you let it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard not to let it sometimes.
I wonder if that's maybe part of the reason that some family members are kind of they put themselves in at a distance from it.
Right. It's there are lots of different reasons in Huntington's. If you're at risk, you fear that mirror image.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of fear in it as well. When they distance themselves, it's a fear that it's too much. Or it's a choice, I suppose. And we could call it a selfish choice, but I mean, I believe that there are people who are selfish too.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of fear associated with it. I don't want to go there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to go there.
Or out of sight, out of mind. Yeah.
Yep. And so there's avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the reasons, Huntington's families are so isolated. Well, that's one of the reasons, but we also isolate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's hard to get out. We don't get out. We tend to try to carry the burden by ourselves too much. I can do this. Why do I need to call in someone to help me? They're not going to do it as well as I can. And I've certainly dealt with that with my patients who burn out. Is that when help comes, that help can't do it as well as they can, and that's true. They can't. But neither can the best help do it 24/7. You know, if you have, in a hospital, if you have a doctor that's on call 36 hours, do you want that person operating on you?
Mm-mm.
No, you don't. And if you are a person with Huntington's needing care, do you want someone who's burned out taking care of you? No, you don't. So of course, we don't want our doctors to work that long, so we should have systems in place that allow that not to happen. But we also need to work not to have someone caring for a person 24/7. I mean, that means the person who's the caretaker has to work at it too.
That's the hard part, you know, when there's no respite in sight and no money to pay for the respite.
There's sometimes when very little can be done, but there are still things. I had a patient who does yoga in her home,
mm-hmm.
and she has a timeout. You know, whatever time of day it is, when her loved one is sleeping. Or is calm or whatever, she does yoga. And, of course, she has a body that she can do it with. But, or, you know, whatever kind of resuscitation that a person can do. I have another one who is a sole caretaker for her husband, and she redecorates one room at a time. It may take her 5 years.
Wow.
But it's important. Her home is beautiful now because she has put her she's at home all the time, so she puts her energy into something beautiful in her home.
Mm-hmm.
And that was life-saving for her.
She has a creative bent that way.
So she handled it that way. Mm-hmm. Not everybody can handle a 24/7. And acknowledging and knowing that you can't is okay. They're different. That doesn't mean that you're not loving or empathetic. It means that you as an individual, can't do this well, and you need help in a long-term care facility or something. One isn't better than the other. It's different for different people. So different strengths that we all have.
It can
and
keep
things
us out
that we
of
can
a,
and can't do.
Being in crisis all the time, too, right?
Yeah.
It could prevent that. I like your idea about journaling. I think that's a really great idea.
When you go back, and I journaled at various, I'm not doing it presently, but have done it in my life when I was most sad and most anxious. And I'll have those times again, probably. I'm a little older and wiser, less capable maybe, but at least older and wiser. And I needed it then because I could go back and see where I was and see, well, I actually have come along. Mm-hmm. You know, I have learned something. I have been able to do something. Not everything. You have to set your goals that are reasonable.
Yeah.
But it was helpful, journaling. If there's no other outlet, then there is journaling. And we have online support groups that we didn't have a generation ago. There are some outlets. They're not perfect.
Right.
None of them. But one does have to seek them out a bit.
Good stuff. Helps you to kind of understand your own feelings and emotions about it.
And those are important.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just understanding that other person that's important. It's understanding yourself.
Right.
Having a little more knowledge of yourself and your responses.
Knowing what your limitations
about
are
them.
Maybe too.
Yeah.
Just how far can you go without, you know, that breaking point?
In the best of physicians, we'll have a breaking point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm a mean doctor, but after many hours on call as an intern, I was a mean doctor. You laugh.
Oh,
and
no.
That is, no, you laugh, but that's true.
I can imagine.
You know, you get angry at the patient because you can't start an IV on them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, where is this coming from? You're just exhausted.
Oh,
get somebody else to do it is what I did.
Yeah.
When it reached that point, just say, I got somebody else instead of losing it.
Very good.
So that's what we have to do. Remember that story. I couldn't start an IV, so I felt angry at the patient. So did I stick that patient again and again and again? Well, too many times, but I finally gave up and got somebody else to do it.
Thank God.
Someone else to do it. Yeah. Remember that story. That's caretaking, too.
Yeah, of course. There's only so much one caregiver can do, right?
And if it gets so your response is inappropriate because you're so exhausted and tired, you're not helping anyone.
No.
And you're making yourself feel guilty.
It worse.
Yep.
More miserable for the patient.
For everybody.
Gosh. Good things to think about, and I really appreciate the article. I love the title. It doesn't look like we have any questions today in the chat room. James, do we have anything else?
No, everybody's paying close attention. Thank you again, Dr. Goodman.
I don't think there's much to disagree with. We need to have empathy, but not kill ourselves with it.
Right. And that goes
and we,
without saying for other
almost, yeah.
aspects in our life, not just caregiving,
right.
but friendship.
You know, one of the things that I think is so important in taking care of Huntington's people, and when I say care partnering, Huntington's people care for the people who are taking care of them. And they want to be helpful, too. They don't want to be a burden. And so...
That is true.
We're not talking just about caretakers. We're talking about people people who are affected by Huntington's or people who are at risk, people who were not... It's a care partnering. Until the very last stages, then it is caretaking. But I call it care partnering. For a long, long time, because the partner can help the care partner too. The person that's affected can learn to know what that person's going through too and how to help. And I believe if that is done very early in a relationship, it preserves the relationship and strengthens it. So know that, you know, when you need to express your... you know, you're irritated about something, don't just scowl. Either one of you.
You know, I'm really glad that you explained that because I didn't really realize what that meant. And so I'm really happy that you
I remember with my husband, you know, I thought, you know, he didn't care anymore because he wasn't responding to me intuitively like he used to.
Yeah.
And I wish, you know, I had known that. Mm-hmm. Then my response would not have been, well, he doesn't care anything about me anymore. Because I know he did.
Mm-hmm.
So why isn't he showing it? Why is this different? It's different because he couldn't read my face anymore and I wasn't talking. I was doing what I always did before.
Mm-hmm.
So talking, realizing what the impairment is, if the person is blind to seeing the expression or can't see it as well, doesn't know, then you can't expect them to see your face in the same way or relate to you in the same way because they can't read that. They can't see it.
Good correlation.
As easily. Yeah. I think that's very important in care of people with Huntington's, all the way. Because I do this with my, what I try to do with people who are having problems like in a nursing home or in a care facility. I try to be a detective and go back and say, well, why was that person upset? You know, is there a pattern to it?
Mm-hmm.
And there often is. And then once you just figure out why it is they're upset and change that, people respond much better. And so that's just a way of, if you know the disease, then you know what to look for.
Mm-hmm.
If you know more about Huntington's, then you know how to deal with it better. I really think that's true.
Me too. I think that's good advice too, because, you know, we're kind of too quick to say, oh, they don't care. Well, they do care.
Right.
They
do care, and that's what this study showed.
Yeah.
And our organization should be teaching that to our families.
Mm-hmm.
It would be good to teach that, and I hope they do. And that's what I'm kind of trying to do here, I guess.
And you're doing a fantastic job. I love the subject. It's just we need to, more people need to hear it. So I'm going to be pushing this out there a lot better.
Have there been other topics that people wanted me to try to learn something about and talk about?
Off the top of my head, I can't think of anything right now, but there are many topics out there, and what we can do is query some of the folks out in the community to see what they want to hear. James, do you have anything off the top of your head there?
Actually, I do have a comment. Give me one second. I think we might have. Okay, just to let everyone know who's listening to the show right now in the chat room, we have a question coming in, and obviously we don't want to mention the person's name. You can at any time double-click on HD Support Groups co-host. That's me and HD Support Groups. That's Melissa. And you can send us a private question, and, of course, anonymity is important. And this question comes in. Okay, our family has an overload of HD in it. I have one aunt out of six who does not have it. 8 out of 9 of her aunts and uncles had it. What are the chances of it skipping me?
50%?
Yes.
When you look at statistics, there will be...
Oh, you're breaking up.
I mean, it's no matter, unless both of her parents, both of this person's parents had the Huntington's gene, that person still has a 50% chance.
Oh.
Her family had bad luck. Mm. And when the coin was tossed, it unfortunately, you know, for each person, it landed... It landed on the side you didn't want.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't change this new person's chances. It's still 50-50.
Yeah, this person continues to state that her mother had it, her twin had it, her three kids had it, her brother just died from it, her older sister
right.
had it, and both
but,
younger
so,
sisters.
But there
it.
Are some families in which all the children will be spared.
Wow.
Exactly.
So if you look at, and wouldn't we like to all be in one of those, but it's when you look at, you know, when you're playing poker, when you're doing the dice, you can sometimes get the same number to come up several times,
mm-hmm.
particularly if you have just a 1 and a 2.
Mm.
So her family had very bad luck. But her chances of having the mutated gene is still 50%, unless both of her parents, like those the Venezuelan family, for instance, there would be a higher chance. Your child is going to have a 75% chance of having it if both parents have the gene, because you would have to have your chances of getting it would be 75% instead of 50.
So what if your one parent is definitely full penetrance, but the other parent is not quite? Would there be a higher chance?
There would be a higher chance that there would be a larger CAG count in that person who was negative. It's the intermediate. You're talking
mm-hmm.
about what's called the intermediate CAG count.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which can then expand in the next generation.
Right. So that would
now
be a
that is a
chance.
Possibility. Yeah.
And that person just gave me permission to say thank you. Her name is Kathy, and she says, thank you, Dr. Goodman.
You're welcome.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting questions that we've had, actually, about the CAG expansions. And how does it expand in future generations, and what if someone is in that, in like you said, intermediary category, and the next generation is at risk or will have it or
potentially at risk.
Potentially at
it
risk.
It doesn't mean that it will necessarily expand.
Right.
You know, the higher, the closer you are to 40, which is the, you know, I think we might need to do a whole show on it. It's probably.
I would love to do that.
And I will try to address that the best way I can, but I'm not the expert on it. I do, Dr. Blair Levitt from BC in Canada gave a great lecture on or a presentation on that at the HSG Symposium. And I'll try to take from his notes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are, BC has done a lot of research on this, and probably Dr. Michael Hayden and Blair Levitt up at UBC are the ones who are most expert at this. So I can get it, I have their information from this this symposium, and we'll try to transmit it correctly.
I mean, I think that is probably one of the most sought after, categories. From the community is how the CAG expansion works, and And, you know, what if someone is in that intermediary category?
What and there's happens? Not going to be, I'll tell you from the beginning, there's not going to be a definite answer.
Right.
Because no one can tell you if you have this particular CAG count that's in an intermediate range, what are the chances that your child will have it in an HD range?
Mm-hmm.
It can only be, we can only talk about statistics.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, there's uncertainty.
Now, did they do any research on juvenile Huntington's as well, or is it the adult?
I mean, for this?
For the CAG, yeah, stats.
For this particular, no.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Because juvenile has a very high number
mm-hmm.
on average, so the intermediate is a low number, not quite in the predicted adult onset range.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can talk a little bit about, you know, CAG expansion that then in generations goes to
mm-hmm.
juvenile. We can talk a little bit about that.
That would be a good subject, I think.
Maybe and there's not a lot known about it, I have to tell you from the beginning, but there's a
yeah.
little bit.
mm-hmm.
Or at least that there's not anything that I'm aware of, except that it's you can't necessarily, there's no predictor that says, you know, this is the one who's going to transmit a much longer repeat than they have.
Do you know if they're doing any studies in Venezuela?
On juvenile, I don't know.
On, the American.
I don't know. I'm going to guess that they have a lot of information
uh-huh.
because I know that there is a lot of juvenile. There is a moderately high proportion of juvenile.
I can imagine.
But I'm not expert enough to answer that question correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I can query Nancy Wexler and about the prevalence of juvenile
mm-hmm.
in that community.
Sure, be interesting.
I'll try to find out.
Okay, that'd be great. Well, I think without further ado, I think we should go ahead and close the show tonight. And unless there's any other questions, James, I don't know.
As a matter of fact, we just did.
Oh, okay.
If you show no signs by the age of 60, is it still possible to get it? This person's aunt is still HD-free.
It is still possible to get it. There have been people who present with it in their 80s. It is, I can say this, that if all the siblings who developed HD developed it much younger, then the chances of her, of this aunt developing Huntington's disease, let's say all of her relatives developed it in their 30s or their 40s, and she has made it to 60 without it, then her chances are relatively good that she won't get it, but not impossible at all. Because as people live longer, we see one of the reasons there's an increased prevalence of Huntington's in this generation is we are seeing people presenting at very late age with Huntington's. I have a person now who is 85.
Oh, wow.
So the age range, when you really look at it, is very large. And we see it later now because, you know, people, you know, during a couple of hundred years ago, no one lived to be 80.
That's true.
And as we have a longer, you know, as the generations go by, we live longer now. More of us live longer. We're not dying of the plague or something, or Indians killing us or us killing them, which is probably the more accurate, way
so
to put it.
The prevalence has increased then?
Yes,
because of that, yeah.
Yeah, now this has been shown in a study in England, and it's what the BC group finds as well. And I think what happens in Canada is probably very similar to what happens in North America.
So do they have new prevalence statistics?
They do.
How can we get those numbers?
I should have them off the top of my head, but I don't. Mm-hmm. It is at least 50% more instead of, 30,000 estimate in the U.S. is probably 45,000. It's that kind of, that's not a prevalence thing, mm-hmm. but it gives you an idea
mm-hmm.
of there is at least that many more. And, of course, we're under-reporting when we count.
Right.
So there's likely to be more. But instead of these 30,000 that was reported a decade ago, it's probably 45,000 at least in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is due to better diagnosis. More diagnosis, more people being diagnosed, and the other is because people are living longer.
True.
So if you live, if you have, and people who develop Huntington's younger are living longer because there's better care
mm-hmm.
than there was two and generations
we
ago.
We also have to, look at the social networking steps that have taken place when more people are actually coming forward.
Yes, no, that's what I mean by under-reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But those who are reporting, so that's why I'm saying 45,000 is probably a low estimate, is
mm-hmm.
the under. But that has contributed more people coming forward is one, and people living longer. And also, so you'd present with it later, and also you live longer, so mm-hmm. you're going to be counted in that number for more years.
True.
So if a person develops symptoms in their 30s, they're going to...
Are these new stats published as well?
Boy, you ask me questions I don't know the answer to. The study in England was certainly published.
Mm-hmm.
I think... No, it is published. It is published.
Mm-hmm.
So I will do an article and I'll learn some things. The BC stuff is published.
Really interesting.
At least it was published in poster form. Oh, I should know the answer to this, and I'm pretty sure it is, but I'm not positive.
It was at the HSG symposium that you
right,
saw
but things are presented there that don't necessarily have to be published.
True, that is true.
But I think it is. I think it has been recently published.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
Just in 2012 or so, but
mm-hmm.
I will have to defer that till next time.
Okay, we'll talk about CAG next time.
Yep.
That would be good.
I'm going to be going to the CHDI conference.
Oh, that's right.
That happens.
Is that in Venice?
Yes, next
Ooh.
Week. And
yeah. That's going to be great.
So I will, actually we're leaving Friday, maybe it's, yeah. It's early next week that it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'll... At some point, I can give an update on some positive things there, too.
I would love to hear some positive things.
Wouldn't we all? Yep.
I think
okay.
all of our listeners would love to hear some positive things.
Sure. Well, thank you.
Very good. Oh, thank you. And this has been a great, informative show. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in tonight. And this does conclude the HD View Ask Dr. Goodman show. And next week, tune in to the show with Danny Cahill. He is winner of The Biggest Loser Season 8, and find out what we all have in common. Don't forget to contact me at helpforhdinternational.org. Find us on Facebook, Help for HD, the HD View. Come back and listen to the recorded episodes. Get the free app on the road, Help for HD. Also available on the app is the original mobile connection to education, resources, and information about JHD and HD. Good night, everyone. Talk to you next week. Have a great week.